company, please call a doctor.
Your call is important to us. Please hold for the next available representative.
The moment you've all been waiting for. It's Dr. Drew. Midday Live with Lauren Savant.
Indeed, that is us, Midday Live. Lauren Savant, Dr. Drew.
That's me.
Just a moment, we'll be speaking with Matthew Brodsky, senior fellow, senior Middle East analyst, security studies in Washington. We are going to look at the unrest in the Middle East today. We have Palestinians over 50 killed, and I understand how. It just seems like a catastrophe. I am so sad that that happened. On the other hand, as you pointed out, Lauren, when you and I were talking about it earlier, we have a sovereign country that wants to put its embassies
wherever it wants to put them.
Yeah. And
that's right.
Why did that create a violent outburst? And what are the meaning? What are the intent of the violent outburst? And as I understand it, the U.S. embassy was moved from Tel Aviv, which our embassy personnel, you used to have to drive to Western Jerusalem, where all the other embassies are, and where the actual capital of Israel is. And now we just moved our embassy to the capital. But let's get some expert advice. What do I know about this? Let's talk to you, Matthew Brodsky, senior fellow Middle East analyst. Thank you, Matthew, for joining us.
Good to be with you again.
So did I have that all wrong, or am I sort of cool?
That was great.
Okay.
I mean, there's obviously a debate on regarding what's happening in Gaza, but on Jerusalem, you know, it's a complex issue when you dig into the political aspects about it, but more or less, that's exactly it.
So on its surface, there's a sovereign country wants to put another sovereign country's embassy wherever the heck it wants to put it, and then putting it in its capital where all the other embassies are. Why does that trigger so much?
Because this isn't actually about the embassy. It's about a million other issues. But just to show you how what you're saying is not only accurate, but even one step beyond that, where the embassy currently, where it's been moved to, is an area that's still in the section of Jerusalem that Israel had always held before the 1967 war and before its modern day, the modern day creation of Israel in 1948. So this is just not even territory that's on the table whatsoever when it comes to negotiations with Palestinians for a final status agreement or a peace accord. This is literally to say that Israel should not be allowed to put their embassy in Western Jerusalem or in this area when their seat of government and everyone is located there, it shows that this isn't really about the placement of an embassy. It's about other issues and different mythologies and, you know, what's happening. And Gaza is, of course, linked in a different way. Of course, that they try to say that has something to do with the embassy, but the march's title is, it's called the March of Return. What that actually means is the March of the Refugees' Right to Return, Hamas, the terrorist group, but also the Fatah, more moderate group that runs the PLO, quote, the negotiating partner that Israel should be engaging with. What they want is the return of over 5 million refugees and their descendants from the 1948 war, 1967 war. And, of course, this is to a country that has 8 million people. So it's literally to call for the destruction of Israel as a state by flooding it with refugees. So the refugee issue is what's happening in Gaza. You have in the West Bank, they're dealing with the embassy issue, but it's not really exactly about the embassy. They're not putting the embassy on top of the Dome of the Holy Rock.
Right.
You know, the holy city is literally 4/10 of a mile, of a square mile.
But I'm wondering why they chose this issue to rally around. Is it just
because all eyes will be on Israel, right? You have the Americans there.
No, but listen, is it just the word Jerusalem that people don't understand? There's exactly what you've explained to us, that it's just a sort of a PR opportunity.
A, it's a PR opportunity. B, there are internal divisions within Palestinian politics, and this is a good thing for them to do, specifically for Hamas and Gaza, who, of course, can't really govern. They get a whole bunch of aid from the international community and from Israel that they allow in, and they're directing those funds into building terror tunnels and, of course, rockets and what have you, everything but reconstructing the enclave there. So to point to Israel is always a useful thing. That's a mainstay of the Middle East. But it's Yeah, this is just how that they've dealt with the problem. They just like to keep their fingers pointed at Israel, and this also points to a much more troubling issue when people talk about the peace process and where it goes from here. Is that Israel had to in 2000, which is when arguably they were the closest to having a peace deal, even though they were still quite a ways away. Israel had to deal with a whole bunch of red lines of their own. You know, were they going to split or divide Jerusalem? If they were, what neighborhoods weren't considered essential? They had to really grapple with a lot of things that they have been telling themselves, not only just as a state that has existed in a modern sense since 1948, but also as, you know, a Jewish people and a religion that through archaeology has shown that they've lived in this area and in this land for a long period of time. So they've had to make a tremendous amount of compromises. The Palestinian side, unfortunately, whether you're talking about the moderates of Fatah, as they're called, or Hamas and Gaza for certain, they've not grappled with this idea. They think that they're going to have a negotiation with Israel, and then somehow Israel's just going to be like, yeah, you know, we look at the Middle East and we think to ourselves, what we want to do is take our holiest sites, our number one holiest site, not our third like it is in Islam, and we'll just hand it over to you guys because that's worked out so well in Syria and everywhere else. That sounds like a wonderful idea. I mean, it's just not going to happen, just like no Israeli leader from the right or the far left in Israel could ever be elected and say, yeah, we're going to allow the return of 5 million refugees to homes that no longer exist in different territory.
Yeah.
You know, to crush Israel. It's not going to happen. So what President Trump is kind of doing here is simply saying, look, I'm sorry. Gravity exists. This may be a problem for you, but you know, the world is also round. And once you start dealing with that, then we can start moving forward because there's really not a whole lot to talk, you know, to talk about. You know, when you get in a conversation with someone and they're just, you don't agree on just such basic facts, you can't take the conversation.
We're talking to Matthew Brodsky, senior fellow Middle East analyst. Why did there have to be violence today? That's the part that I find, or not just violence, but lethal violence. It's sort of confusing to me. Go ahead.
Okay, this has been a campaign planned by Hamas for several weeks now, where it started with after mosque services on Friday protests. So it would be each Friday, and they were hoping to build a crescendo. And what it is, again, they call it the March of Return so that all the refugees can return. Now, they are really savvy when it comes to their campaign as far as using news media and how they're going about social media, because they're trying to portray it as some kind of spontaneous, hi, we just decided this Friday to, you know, tens of thousands of us get together and do this. But it's a Hamas movement that's designed literally to sacrifice their own population to score either political points, or if you take them for what they're really doing, which is to try to charge and rush through the Gaza border, then it is to literally present Israel with the issue of armed terrorists just rushing into Israel, which no country would, of course, allow to happen at their border.
Was this return of fire from Israel? Were these guys running in with machine guns, or were they... what was the situation? Were they unarmed?
Well, for today specifically, there are 40,000 Palestinians that were dealing or involved in violent riots. It happened in 13 locations throughout the Gaza Strip and along the security fence. So they're hurling firebombs, explosive devices, and trying to destroy and bring down the security fence. Of course, they're burning tires, which normally environmentalists would care about, but for some reason, the Palestinians, they like so much they can get away with anything when it comes to these type of, quote, protests. But yeah, of course, they're throwing rocks, they're launching flaming rockets, of course, they've had kites that they put Molotov cocktails in, that they've flown over, and then they're painted with swastikas. I mean, this is what they're trying to this is what, unfortunately, too many in the mainstream media is trying to present as some spontaneous protest. And why is Israel, you know, acting like it is? Well, this morning, as it has every week, it already flew over Gaza and dropped thousands of flyers in Arabic that were saying, don't do this. Don't, you know, there will be consequences. Don't listen to Hamas and do this. But Hamas, we've already seen, has been paying protesters to go out there and to charge the fence. They've hired buses to carry these protesters. They've even been working, you know, to go through the process that they've gone through to set up the porta potty type of situations, to make this a fair type of environment, you know, some festival type of thing, when they could really be using their money towards building something stable for the people. This is what they're doing. And so Israel is acting like any sovereign country would do, which is to not allow terrorists to go through the border. And I think after today, tomorrow, and the next few days, today was supposed to be the greatest explosion, so to speak, of this type of violence, because it was supposed to be the crescendo. And incidentally, more of average Gazans were coming out in the beginning, about like a month or two ago when this started on the Fridays. But the numbers have tapered off more, but the violence has increased because the cover that Hamas has been using, you know, has been dissipating. Today, though, was special because it is actually the eve of what they call Al-Nakba, which to them is the catastrophe, which, of course, for Israelis is called Independence Day. So I think after this, you know, it kind of fizzles out a bit more, unless Hamas continues to spend, you know, their money this way. But I really think it's been a law of diminishing returns from them. Even Saudi Arabia has told Fatah in the West Bank, you know, you've got to listen to whatever the Trump offer deal is going to be for peace. And frankly, you need to pretty much accept it, because everyone's kind of getting sick of you and we just don't want to put up with you. So well, enough already.
We're talking to Matthew Brodsky, senior fellow, senior Middle East analyst, security studies in Washington. And is the Iranian moves in any way muscling some of this?
The Iranian moves are separate, but in are you referring to attack against Israel?
Yeah,
is that a funding source for some of the guys, some of the Hamas and whatnot? And is the fact that Iran's getting choked now going to trickle down to Palestine?
It could. On the last part, yes. Iran getting choked could have implications for the capabilities of terrorists in Gaza. Iran, yes, they do pay for different terrorist groups inside of Gaza. And should there become a larger war between Israel and Iran, that would most likely be fought in Syria, but also expanded into Lebanon, then you could expect those cells in Gaza to be participating, that Iran pays for, just to add on another front. But they do absolutely spend money on terrorism, and it's not a cutoff because they're Shia, but most of the Palestinians are Sunni, so they don't give to them. It doesn't matter.
And one other question I have is, it seemed like when Benjamin Netanyahu went to Russia and spoke to Putin, and then the next day, massive military assault in Syria on Iranian positions, that is a tacit participation with Russia, right? Am I wrong here? Russia wants Iran out of Syria, and Israel's going to do it for them, and Putin sort of wink-winked, and off they went. Is that...
Not exactly, but the conversation that Netanyahu had was, it's astonishing the extent to which Putin said okay to whatever Netanyahu said right there, but he did it, and it works out well for him. In a nutshell, Russia secured, with its air force in Syria, Iranian troops on the ground who secured Assad, the ruler of Syria, the current butcher. So Iran has been dependent on Russia and vice versa in the short and in the medium term. But in the long term, both of them, Russia and Iran, want to be in control, or the puppeteer of Syria and of Assad. Israel, unfortunately, has one concern. Unfortunately, from Russia's perspective, has one concern, and that's Iran creating bases and infrastructure and a new forward operating positions in Syria to fight Israel, which is what it's doing, and that's what happened last weekend. Israel essentially went to Russia again in around their 10th meeting between Netanyahu and Putin in the past 3 years, and said, look, this is really how the conversation pretty much went. Netanyahu said to Putin, we're going to attack Iran. We can't have them here. We're going to leave Assad, your puppet, alone.
Yeah.
That's totally fine. He'll secure your position.
Yeah.
That, we're fine with it, but we're dealing with Iran, and Russia pretty much said, okay.
Yeah, that's what it seemed like to me. That's exactly what it seemed like. And then that's the new geopolitical sort of alchemy that stoichiometry is playing out there. All right, Mr. Brodsky, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it. Is there a website you'd like to refer people to?
Mine is www.matthewrjbrodsky.com or securitystudies.org or on Twitter at RJ Brodsky, Brodsky.
Thank you, sir, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lawrence Vaughn, it's Dr. Drew. It's Midday Live.
KABC has dependable traffic.